Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. In her phenomenal new book, God's Property, Islam, Charity and the Modern State, Nada Mumtaz charts the historical continuities and disjunctures, as well as contemporary paradoxes shadowing the intellectual and sociological career of waqf, or Islamic charity or endowment, in modern Lebanon. Nimbly moving between layered textual analysis, riveting ethnography, and formidable historical inquiry, Mumtaz demonstrates the secularization and sectarianization of waqf in Lebanon, premised on the attempted state separation between the spheres of the public and the private, and religion and economy. While exploring the workings of waqf historically, intellectually, and as part of everyday life with meticulous detail, Mumtaz constantly connects the details of her study to its broader argument, centered on critiquing the secular promise of separating religion and economy as distinct domains of life. This beautifully written book will be widely read and taught in multiple disciplines, including anthropology, religion, Islamic studies, and history. Here now is my conversation with Professor Nada Mumtaz. Hello, Nada. Welcome to the New Books Network. Thank you so much for your time and for writing this really incredible book that, as I was saying before I pressed record here, really I think will spark some great conversations, and really is an incredible book because it very successfully is situated at the intersection of so many different fields, including anthropology, theories and methods in anthro and religion, Islamic studies, sort of more classical Islamic studies, history, and so on. So it really is quite an achievement. I want to congratulate you for it. And as a way to begin our conversation, Nada, as you will know that on the New Books Network, we begin by asking our authors about their intellectual journeys. And I was wondering if you could share with our listeners a bit about how you became a scholar of anthropology, Islam, and so on and so forth. How did you become a scholar first?
Thank you so much, Sher Ali, for having me and for reading and engaging. Well, I will first say that I never really intended to become a scholar or an anthropologist. Before applying to graduate school, I was working as an architect and was a bit perhaps disappointed in the practice because I had so much hope through my training, because when I was an architecture student at the American University of Beirut, my social horizons were blessed, and I was like, we had read people like Lefebvre and Foucault and Bourdieu, and I was particularly drawn into, you know, these questions about how space shapes people and people shape space, and that was what we engaged with mostly during design and the design studios that we took. And then here I was working as an architect, and you realize that the design process where you're thinking about these questions is basically a couple of months, and then you move on to construction documents and, you know, development of the design development and these phases that take up years. And so at the time I thought, okay, well, maybe that's a good time for me to do a PhD to continue thinking about these questions. So it was supposed to be an interlude, and basically before going back to Lebanon and doing work around urban interventions and urban research and policy. And it was really friends and mentors who suggested anthropology. I had thought perhaps I'll do urban planning, but then they were joked and said, well, you know, you are interested in the social, because they used to nickname me Netta Social. So that was kind of the context of where I was coming from. And I was also interested by also things happening in the city at the time around me, which was particularly the Islamic revival. And just to kind of say that also, I want to pause perhaps for a second and say that it's really hard and sad and, you know, it creates a lot of difficult feelings for me for the book to come out in the midst of the worst crisis in Lebanese history. And it just is nonsensical to be talking about waqfs when people don't have electricity or fuel or food or medication, and their salaries have lost 90% of their value, and their savings have disappeared in banks who are not giving it to them, and, you know, all of that. So it just feels awkward to be happy. I'm trying to compartmentalize, but it's still difficult. I try to say, well, hopefully there will be some time and space to think, and things hopefully will eventually get better. And maybe then that work will be useful. But it's hard to cling on to any hope these days. Something just to kind of say that this is part of what is happening. and to come back to your question about how I became a scholar, and when I started the PhD, I was interested in that revival and the forms Islam were taking at the time, which were different from the ones they took when I was growing up. There's all of these study circles. People started to go to, like, the mosque to pray Taraweeh prayers in Ramadan. So I was interested in, you know, what drew people to that revival? What was it about, its appeal and its forms? And so at the time also, as I said, anthro, I thought, was would be helpful because of the big theoretical kind of foundation that it would give me, because I was also slightly disappointed in the way architects use theory, because they were mostly picking and choosing, which I feel like, yes, it's a good way to activate theory, but if I'm trying to do some, like, you know, research, I don't want to use contradictory frameworks, etc. So anyways, all of this to say is that I basically ended up applying to anthropology, and because I was interested in the revival, I came eventually to use and read quite widely Islamic studies, Islamic legal studies, anthro history, political theory, whatever would help me really understand these questions I was interested in. And so I think that also reflects what you talked about at the beginning of the episode, which is the fact that my work is really truly interdisciplinary. And so my focus on these Islamic endowments, which, you know, they are both an act of charity and a form of property, came during my PhD, and they were a good site for me, because they brought together my interest in the urban with the Islamic revival. And in thinking about it, you know, it's also an interesting aspect of the revival to study, because it's also less dictated dictated by the Western gaze, I would say.
So I wanted to begin by sort of talking about the larger sort of conceptual architecture of the book and the key theme. And one of the things that your book really shows is that this category of waqf that you might sort of, one might, you know, loosely translate as Islamic endowment, etc., is such an extremely complicated category with many different shades, etc. You've already begun to talk about this, but maybe, you know, for listeners who may not be familiar, maybe you could talk a bit about this category of waqf and what makes it so complicated as a category, the different sort of modalities it can take. But then I also wanted to more substantively have you talk a bit about the theoretical sort of structure or architecture of the book, which you really very beautifully lay out in your introduction in talking about a grammatical analysis of Waqf and what that means for you. So I was wondering if you could also briefly describe for our listeners what does a grammatical analysis of Waqf mean and entail.
It is true that the impetus for a lot of the book comes from a question that arose partly during my ethnographic research, which is, what is this Waqf thing? I assumed I knew what Waqf was because I had read a lot of Islamic legal studies and histories of Waqf. And so I assumed I knew what it meant. And it was only when I encountered people in the quote-unquote field that I started to better understand that what I thought was Waqf was different from what my interlocutors thought was Waqf. So this made me experience something that I was also familiar with theoretically, but now I was experiencing kind of, you know, in my body. And that's the fact that meaning varies according to context, which is an insight I take from Asad, who takes it from Wittgenstein. So to answer your question, a grammatical analysis is one that looks at meanings in context, or as Wittgenstein puts it, it's the rules for the use of a word. And so he uses grammar, Wittgenstein does, in a way that's different, say, from a linguist who talks about grammar, which is more familiar to us through rules like, you know, the orders of declarative sentences, subject, object, verb, or in French, things like all nouns that end in OU have plurals that end with S, or, you know, with X, except some that end with S. Or for Arabic speakers, المبتدأ مرفوع, you know, things like that. So, but for Wittgenstein, that is not his interest. He's interested in the meaning of words in context and the kind of what he calls basically these contexts, he calls them language games. And it reminds me a little bit of what my French teacher used to tell us, that we should not look up words in the dictionary while reading novels unless it was really essential, and that eventually by reading a lot, watching TV, etc., we would get a much more nuanced understanding of the word and the senses in which it's used by seeing it used in context. So I think that's kind of what I was trying to do in seeing how people use that word and what it really means. So when I was trying to understand these different meanings as an anthropologist, there were different sorts of context. You know, there was the everyday uses and there was legal uses in the contemporary Lebanese context. But there was also something else, which is these different historical contexts. So in my case, the language game, if you will, the context was not stable. So to talk about these different contexts, I kind of use the word architecture, which is, you know, the language game when I'm talking about a form of life. So that's why when I read about Waqf's and historical studies, I thought it was a different thing than what my interlocutors in Beirut thought it was today. And so to answer the question about what Waqf is, I would have to say it depends on context. And even though, of course, because it's anchored in the Islamic tradition, it does have some continuities. So Waqf is first and foremost an act of charity. But what does that charity look like? And that is partly what has changed. Part of what I do is trace that the forms that this charity took. So in 19th century Beirut, based on the Sharia records I examined and Ottoman, you know, legal literature, Waqf involves usually an immovable that has a benefit that is dedicated in perpetuity to charity. So there's also some, you know, exceptions about movables, and there's about cash, but we don't need to get into these here. But so in some sense, there's two main kinds of Waqfs. One is the things that are in and of themselves providing for charitable purposes, like a mosque or a school or a water fountain or soup kitchen, all of these institutions that provide purposes, whose purposes are charitable. And if one does that to help people, you know, learn about and pray and etc., this is considered charity. And then there's also another enormous part of the other forms of waqfs that I've seen, which are attached to these institutions and financing them. So the shops and the lands and buildings and, you know, rooms even, whose revenues support these institutions as well as the poor. So through distribution of revenues, bread, and even sometimes, you know, another beneficiary for these lands and shops as well are the families of founders. And I will get into that perhaps later in another question when we talk about the family as a legitimate kind of recipient of charity. So that's 19th century Beirut. Now, fast forward, you know, to when I'm doing research in the late 2000s. And with the waqf founders, the first thing I noticed was that the waqf of shops or land was not common anymore, and it was mostly Islamic centers and mosques. But I also was surprised to see waqfs that did not really involve any immovable. You know, they were mostly looking like NGOs or nonprofits, as you call them in the States. So NGOs being non-governmental organizations. So some people dedicated very little money, $100 or $200, to create an association for the defense of human rights or to create an association for the defense against Western imperialism. And though in these, the waqf stopped being an immovable whose revenues support a charitable purpose and becomes more importantly a kind of a shell for a moral person that can then own property and can do fundraisers and have a bank account, etc. So I was partly interested in understanding what were the conditions that opened the space for waqf to become this person, this moral person. What are the possibilities that this new form of waqf opens for Muslims operating in Beirut under the Lebanese state rather than, say, under an Ottoman Empire?
No, it's completely fine. It's just don't think too much about the lines. Don't worry about it. Okay, thank you so much. I think one of the great things about every chapter in this book is the way you look at a particular conceptual problem and then you historically chart it from, talking about it in the classical sort of Islamic thought and the Ottoman period and then more sort of contemporary and modern transformations. And that is especially true for your first chapter in which you talk about ways in which what one might call the sociological or epistemic position of waqf in the late Ottoman Empire sort of straddled between the temporal worldly realm, but also the hereafter in terms of the rewards for something like articulation of waqf was reserved for the hereafter. And it was not reducible to the status of a moral person, that sort of more dominant sort of positionality that it took later. So could you talk a bit about this transformation or this argument, especially in terms of the position of waqf in the late Ottoman Empire, and how did it straddle these two sort of realms of the worldly and the hereafter, and how was it not reducible to this idea of a moral, quote-unquote moral?
Thank you for this question. You just made me realize one thing I would like to highlight, that this kind of broader transformation that I chart is also not linear. So partly what I'm interested in is the way these older conceptions continue to exist today. That the kind of modern conception could have existed in the tradition, but as minor traditions. So I feel like partly what I'm trying to do is to think about how these different conceptions can coexist within a tradition, while some being more dominant than others, and what are the historical, political, social, economic contexts that make one tradition become more dominant. So, for example, the question of waqf as a moral person existed in the 19th century. If you read some of the more polemical books or articles, you know, scholarly literature today about waqf, some would claim that waqf was not a moral person. And that's one of the reasons why, it didn't develop to become the shell for like a model for a corporation that could have helped with capital accumulation and helped develop the Muslim world. So that kind of, that becomes one way why the Muslim world, quote unquote, didn't develop its own kind of forms of capitalism. But in fact, when you examine what's in archival documents, these mostly accounting documents and lawsuits, and not just the legal texts, which always state the waqf has no dhimma or legal personality, you realize that in fact, in the practice, in these court documents, in these archival documents, the administrators and judges act as if the waqf has a dhimma. And that is something that has been noted by a few scholars who work on waqf. So, for example, the waqf lent money to another waqf, or the administrator has limited liability that make it so that the waqf is almost itself like liable. But even though it almost acted like a moral person, it was not to say the dominant way that waqf was approached, that we think about it as this, you know, corporation or non-profit organization or an association that has a life of its own. So anyways, just to come back to the substance of the question about waqf as it straddles the here and now and the hereafter, I would say that one important aspect of waqf is that it is both about making profit and putting this profit towards charity, doing good and getting close to God in the hereafter. So it's one of one way through which economic activity, when done with the right intent, can bring rewards in the hereafter. So that's kind of one of these ways that, you know, the waqf straddles, you know, these two realms. In the Hanafi tradition, and the dominant one that is most commonly used in the Ottoman Empire, the founder surrenders the ownership of the waqf to God. So God becomes the owner of the waqf. So as you can see, that's kind of where the title of the book comes from. So in some ways, that makes it so that there are many characters in the property relations that the waqf creates. There's the founder, who sees it to be the owner. There's the beneficiaries. And then there's the administrator. But then there's God, who is now the owner. So with a property regime that is instituted by the French in Lebanon starting in the 1920s, there's no space for God as an owner, whose agent, you know, the administrators will take care and rent the waqf and distribute its revenues. So in the French property registry deeds, there was one space for the owner. And you can imagine, you know, there's God is not really, you know, going to be put there as the owner. So the surveyors usually put, you know, beneficiaries, or they can put the original founder, or they can put the administrator, or they can actually put the waqf. And that's exactly what happens, is that, you know, the surveyors put in the waqf as the owner. And it's in this very inconspicuous moment that you start seeing how the waqf itself becomes an owner and a moral person who owns property. It's, you know, it's a shift that happens through some practices. And, you know, that's one way, that's kind of one of the ways that help move the waqf to become a moral person. But of course, there's also the creation of the laws of corporation that also allows that new form of waqf to become legible legally. But the gist of it is that, you know, the absence of God from the cast of characters in property relations, they help solidify that minor tradition that had existed before of making waqf into a moral person. And so really partly also one of the effects of that is that the waqf ceases to be thought of as a very worldly financing structure. That brings revenues, it brings rewards to their founders in the hereafter. So it kind of has these both realms together, and rather becomes this association that is kind of in and of itself, you know, either doing good or itself just, it's itself doing good.
Now, another great virtue of this book is that it always connects these very detailed readings that you're doing of texts and, you know, sort of the ethnographic site. But then you always constantly connect it to the larger theme of the book as I read it, which is to really highlight some of the paradoxes and some of the irresolvable contradictions of modern state sovereignty, modern state power, and secular power, more broadly speaking. And I think perhaps in no other chapter does that come through in more striking ways than the next one, in which you talk about the DGIW that I will have you describe. My main question is, what is the DGIW, and how do some of the paradoxes that shadow its role as a supposed controller of waqf highlight some of the larger paradoxes of secular power and modern state power?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, thank you so much for this great compliment. For me, the hardest part of the project is how not to get buried in the weeds and to move between detail and theory and connect the detail to the bigger conceptual questions I'm interested in. But I will also say that part of me is also very interested in the weeds. You know, I'm interested in understanding how things are exactly working and why, but I'm also interested in the practicalities of how we can operate and operationalize waqf in Lebanon in a more radical way. So partly the weeds matter for an audience that will read the book, which are the people who might be reading the book, not just for its theoretical interventions, but in Lebanon, who are looking at these legal details and historical precedents that can animate waqf today differently and towards different projects than the ones that exist in the current configuration of the state today and the way they hook waqf into that system. So in some ways, these tensions between the kind of super detail and the more theoretical is partly also, I'd say, the way my book tries to talk to these different audiences. And one of these audiences, as you mentioned, is, you know, those interested in thinking about secularism and modern state power and their paradoxes. I will note that one of the paradoxes I encountered was regarding what you might call as a shorthand, quote-unquote, straight state control of waqfs. I say quote-unquote state control because I don't want to say, like, you know, with a modern state, now they're state controlled. Before, there was no state control. Of course, before the 19th century, most waqfs were administered locally, that's right. But the judges supervised the administrators. And even though there was no procedure for supervision, it's not that the administrators submitted a yearly accounting to the judge or anything of that sort. But if any problem arose, beneficiaries or administrators took it to the judge. So the state was kind of, you know, is there through the judges that it appoints. But it was, the state was not involved in the administration of waqf, even if it was involved in supervision. And today there is a different structure that is much more involved with both supervision and administration, and that's the Directorate General of Islamic Waqfs, the DGIW, which administers a lot, but not actually all waqfs. That's also something I won't get into here. So the DGIW, is the heir of the Ottoman Waqf Ministry that was founded in 1826. And so when I started doing my research, I noticed that the Waqf, the direct DGIW, was trying to control, quote unquote, Waqf foundations. So, for example, they'd issue these decrees saying, you know, Waqf founders should get a permission from the DGIW if they're going to do a Waqf. So I found that surprising, since I was like, well, the DGIW, as the heir of the Ottoman Waqf Ministry, I mean, they've been trying, they've done that before, I thought. And after 200 years, why are they still trying to do that? And I think that one of that is, one of the reasons behind that is, as you mentioned, these paradoxes of the modern state and law. And so one of these paradoxes is the attempt to fit into these legal categories complex phenomena like Waqf that don't work according to the categories of civil law that was imported by the French. So the question becomes, like, is Waqf subject to property law or personal law? Is it economy that will be regulated by real estate property, the real estate property code, or and contract law? Or is it religion that will be basically delegated and regulated through this personal status law devised by religious communities? And so this... And just to note that this personal status law, as many people who do work on, secularism in that region of the world, as well as in many colonial settings, will know that personal status law is part of the secular configuration of Lebanon, and it was enshrined by the French. So while property law, contract law, etc., criminal law were common to all and legislated by parliament, religious communities had legal sovereignty over the domain of quote-unquote religion and matters of marriage, divorce, and partly waqf, and some communities also custody and inheritance. So it was also like the attempt to distinguish, you know, in Waqf, the domain of the religious from that of the economic, is also part of that operation of secular power. And so because Waqf is both, there will always be, in fact, competing legislation and jurisdiction over Waqf. And this jurisdiction is split between organs of the state. So there's different courts and the directorate and ministries. And that is what my one of my interlocutors called flou, or the indeterminacy of the law of Waqf. And that's partly also what creates this kind of constant struggles between different people to kind of make use of different laws of Waqf to different purposes, and allows for some paradoxes it allows mostly for the way I have seen the DGIW constantly attempt to control, because it is competing with these other ministries and directorates, etc., to have control over Waqf. So the Waqf in some ways allows us to see how the modern state is not one thing. It's a project that's, you know, constantly in the making, and the contradictions that arise in the attempt to subject complex things like the Waqf to these secular logics.
Okay. We'll come back to it. So the other sort of another question or place where you show these effects and the sort of continuities and disjunctures to great effect is on this fascinating discussion you have perhaps the most detailed chapter in this book, which is this chapter on intent. I believe it's chapter 3, in which you show ways in which this increased emphasis on the question of intent as part of Waqf, on the intention of the person making Waqf, how that led to the development of a new debt regime from the mid-19th century onwards, and what were some of the effects of that. And you show some interesting, you know, again, continuities and disjunctures from a previous sort of debt regime. Could you talk a bit about, I know this chapter was incredibly rich, and I'm sort of asking you a very broad question, so, you know, please pick on any part of it that you may wish, but if you could talk a bit about why this category of intent is so central and how its centrality led to the development of a new debt regime from the mid-19th century onwards, and what were some of the continuities and disjunctures from the previous debt regime?
Yes, this is one massive and dense chapter where I go over debt and foreclosure regimes in addition to political economic transformations in Mount Lebanon in Beirut. So I won't go into all of the details here, but I will perhaps pick on the question of intent. And intent is really crucial for action in Islamic law, and it's usually the first maxim in Islamic legal maxims manuals. So innam al-a'mal bin niyyat, and so waqf is the qualification of an action is determined by its intent. So for waqfs, the intent of getting close to God is what defines waqf as charity, and intent is what defines the kind of action that waqf is and the rewards one will get in the hereafter. But what's very interesting is that in the Islamic legal tradition, or the Hanafi tradition that I have encountered in these courts in Beirut, you rarely see discussions of intent in the chapter on waqf in the Hanafi court Ottoman canon. And I've never encountered litigation in the Sharia court records, litigation over intent. There's nobody who comes to court and says, well, really what they're trying to do is something else. Their intent is not charity, but to deprive, say, one of their heirs of property. The challenges are usually done through more technical and procedural matters, like, oh, the waqf was done during a terminal illness. They were done according to this definition or that. And so that's how they come. The challenge comes through practice rather than, what people were trying to do. So I was really surprised to find in the Ottoman archive this enormous file from the 1870s, where the governor of Mount Lebanon asks the Sheikh al-Islam, the highest Islamic legal authority in the Ottoman Empire, what do you do with these people who are doing waqf to discate debt? So what is happening really is because waqf is God's property, nobody can buy it, sell it, or mortgage it, waqf becomes an important shield from foreclosures. This pushed me to try and understand why suddenly these foreclosures became so big, and they triggered such a response and the uses of the waqf to shield them. So what I do in the chapter is I trace, I think that the question arises because of changing property and debt regimes. And so the property regime, the debt regime earlier on was very much local, part of the everyday. And in the Islamic legal tradition, there was a very much conjoined with an injunction for forgiving debts and those who are incapable of paying them. So the regime becomes very different with the rise of capitalism in the 19th century, in the way debt becomes much more tied to foreign capital, to merchants who are in Beirut, who are, tied to capitalists in France from whom they are borrowing. So these people are not necessarily tied to that network of people in Mount Lebanon, so it necessitates more legible regulations that allow for foreclosure. So, of course, I'm here using, a very broad brush. And in fact, I do more in the book to parse the complexities and to say foreclosure, of course, existed before, but it kind of was not the dominant approach. And so partly because of the rise of this regime of foreclosure, waqfs became shields, and so they became suspicious. And so when I was analyzing this file, I was also at the time reading Hassan Agrama's book, Questioning Secularism, where he talks about suspicion as a kind of modality that very much suffuses the modern rule of law. And he traces it to liberalism's kind of vigilance against abuses of power. But that was not a question really of, a question of liberalism and in the last quarter of the 19th century in the Ottoman Empire. That was definitely not a liberal moment. So instead, what I was seeing is that this kind of suspicion seems to be arising in connection to property and debt regimes and basically to kind of the demands of capital. So I'm not suggesting that there's direct causality, but I think it's interesting to know that this is part of the context under which suspicion towards the intent of wealth makers arise.
Another shift that you talk about in this really fascinating and in some places really interesting, entertaining chapter on the shift from family-based waqf to the question of waqf based on merit, this shift from family to merit, and how that sort of shifts, that shift also maps onto this other major division that is a central theme of this book, which is between the religion and economy, which is one of the major sort of modern sort of ruptures that you find in the conceptual economy of waqf. And that, of course, is then connected to the increasing subsumption or, safeguarding of waqf by the modern state and modern state control. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about this shift from family to merit and how that then connects to this larger division that you keep on coming back to in the book between religion and economy.
An important aspect of waqf and waqf making in Ottoman Beirut particularly, and I would say more broadly, is the fact that the family was considered one of the utmost charitable purposes. And giving to family, taking care of family, particularly the poor in a family, was a priority of charitable giving, which then, you know, in some ways starts from the inside outwards. So in the law of waqf in the Hanafi tradition and beyond, there was no distinction between, you know, what we would today consider quote-unquote public charity, like mosques and schools, and private charity that goes and supports family. In fact, in the chapter, I show that even the utmost public waqfs, the mosques, there was family transmission of offices. And so imams and khatibs and all these different functions were very much transmitted from father to son, because of course these are male positions. So as long as they had the skills. So it's not that the merit was not taken into account, of course, but family was the first logic of transmission in these waqf offices. And I would just say, in bigger cities, just a parenthesis, there was debates about how these offices were monetized and so could be acquired as a sinecure. But that is not what I found in Beirut. I think in smaller cities, much smaller endowments, that was not much of an issue. And so towards the middle of the 19th century, with Ottoman reforms, you start seeing a reversal of this logic of appointment and an attempt to prioritize merit, with family now becomes secondary and eventually even dropped. So I would say that this is partly related to the refiguration of the notion of public and private, when modern state power becomes very much articulated around the economy and growing that economy, increasing wealth and progress, and that is what defines public benefit. So waqfs that are dedicated to family become a way that wealth is kept in the private and not really circulating. And so these waqfs become particularly suspicious. And that's where giving to family becomes an obvious sign, you know, that the founders do not really intend to do charity, but have a variety of ulterior motives. That is where that question of suspicion of intent that I discuss in the earlier chapter kind of collides with the question of suspicion towards family, giving to family as charity in the economy. And so giving to family in these circumstances becomes more suspicious as an act of charity, and most people today would not think of giving to charity as an act of as an act of charity. And this shift crystallizes in the French Mandate, where waqfs that are dedicated to family become classified by the French as not really religious. They have even separate regulations. So contrary to the Hanafis, who consider all of these waqfs to have the same rules, the same laws, waqfs in the French Mandate becomes split between the quote-unquote properly religious, which are mosques and other public amenities like Sufi lodges, and those that belong to the economy. And the French mandatory powers issue many regulations that attempt to bring the family wealths into the economy by allowing the sale or what is known as exchange or even end of certain wealths. So basically, profit in that kind of scheme becomes opposed to charity. And wealths that are truly charitable are those are religious, and those who are profit-making enterprises like the shops become separated from them. And you start to see that separation between religion and economy. That is one aspect also of secularization.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. As a final substantive question that I want to ask you about, a key theme of this book, a key sort of argument that you find, especially examined towards the end of the book, which is this larger theme about the secularization of waqf and the increasing sort of state control of waqf that through legislation, etc. And you sort of end the book on this very sort of poignant slogan that came out in 2019 during the anti-government protests in Beirut and elsewhere in Lebanon, the tax the waqf, or tax the waqf, I guess. And you talk about ways in which that slogan sort of highlights a sort of a certain critique of the secularization and also sectarianization of waqf. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about and tell our listeners a bit about what that means, the secularization and the sectarianization of waqf, and how that again in turn sort of highlights this key theme of the book, which is to talk about the paradoxes of modern state sovereignty and its attempt to separate the public and the private sphere or the domains of religion and economy. If you could talk a bit about that key theme of the book.
So tax the waqfs was a slogan, as you mentioned, that was painted during the revolution that swept through the country back in 2019. So it was spray painted on both a mosque and a church in Beirut city center. And, you know, there's so many ways to read that slogan. It's, of course, similar, you know, to tax the rich. So you can say that it's a critique of neoliberalism. But there's also a specificity to it, you know. It's not just any rich. It's about the mosque and the church. It's about religion. It's the waqfs as the quote-unquote religious property of these religious communities as waqfs become defined by the French. So it's this association between waqfs and religious communities, which are known as tawa'if, sects, in Lebanon, that you see what I call the sectarianization of waqf, the way they become tied to religious communities that make up this nation. So this is quite different from the way they were thought of in the 19th century, for example, when they were most importantly thought of as individual endeavors rather than serving to define and reproduce a particular community within a nation or a one cannot make a waqf whose beneficiaries were the Muslims, because Muslims included the rich and the poor, so the charitable purpose was not going to be actually actualized. Whereas if you think about a madrasa that serves Muslims only, it could serve both rich and poor. But here, the charitable goal is educating Muslims, so it's achieved just through education. And so to make a waqf whose revenues went to Muslim was too broad a category for jurists. So this idea of this tying of waqfs to a particular community within a larger kind of nation state, this is what I call the sectarianization, is something that we can also see in the slogan. So one can read the slogan also as a critique of this the way waqfs are tied to religious communities and some of the effects of that. So by providing tax exemptions to waqfs, the state is missing out on taxes that could be used that it could use itself to develop services like education, health, food baskets, whatever you want, or food stamps, etc. But instead, by giving these tax breaks to these religious waqfs, these services are provided by the religious communities, which then reproduces citizens as more attached to these communities than to the state. So, I mean, this is definitely the case. But I would say that the tax exemptions of waqf is definitely not a result of the power of these sects, but rather of tax exemptions according to charities under a broader kind of taxation laws. And that is actually, in addition to being also a leftover from when the state took over the administration of waqfs in the Ottoman Empire, and that basically made these the money of waqf be actually state money. And so it was just because of the conflation kind of the Ottoman with the Muslim majority. And so they became kind of unmarked, and that was state money rather than Muslim kind of waqfs. And now the sectarianization is one aspect of secularization, because the making of Muslim sects as Muslims as one sect, among others, is part of the secular configuration of Lebanon. So the fact that, you know, there's a civil state that's equally distant from all religious traditions, instead of now having an Islamic state the way the Ottoman kind of defined itself towards, you know, we shouldn't go into that debate. But, I mean, so another, I mean, an important aspect also of tax the waqf is that it brings out some of the contradictions of secularism about the constant, you know, question of how to separate state and religion. And here it offers a new answer to what we think when we think about it through the economy. So it's not, you know, it's not calling for less intervention. In fact, there's a demand for more circulation of money, but it's direction that matters. So it's, we want to circulate religion money from quote-unquote religion to the states. And there's other aspects to that secularization, you know, the fact that, you know, now there's a certain imminent frame, the way God is not recognized as an owner of property, the question of religion and economy also. So, you know, secularization also appears in these waqfs, also through these aspects.
Sure, absolutely. Not at all. This is incredible. This is wonderful. This is really, really wonderful. As we're coming to the end of our time, Nada, and of course, this is such a rich book that we've only, I emphasize this to our listeners, that I've only taken some sort of large, broad themes of the book, but really the delight of this book is in the details in some ways. It's just really incredible in terms of the sort of ways, as I said, it brings together the ethnography, the historical analysis, the textual analysis. I think the analysis of Ibn Nujaym and Ibn Abidin itself is just incredible in this book. It's a part that I thoroughly enjoyed myself. So as we come towards the end of our time, Nada, I was wondering if you could share a bit with our listeners about what are you working on or planning on doing as the next project. I know you just finished a really massive and important book here, but what is your anticipation of what the next project might look like?
I'm thinking of and working on a few different projects at this time, but I haven't exactly settled on anything in particular, because I think it will all depend on what happens in Beirut, because it is the place I'm committed to, and so I need to see what will be useful there. So one of the things that I'm interested in further exploring is the question of the waqfs in the city center and the reconstruction project after the civil war that ended in 1990. So that project, you know, started in 1990, but earlier also, but formalized in 1994. And it's still ongoing. They had a 25-year contract, and it was extended for another 10. So it's such an important model and point of comparison for the reconstruction happening now, a year after the explosion. And it's also been used in so much in the Arab world, in Syria, etc. And in that reconstruction model, most property owners were expropriated and given shares in the company in charge of reconstruction. But some wolves managed to escape that fate. So it was an interesting problem because there was so much mobilization against the massive expropriation of the real estate holding company, you know, that they did. There was organizing through property rights and law, but that didn't really work. I mean, even though it was massive, I mean, we know that you know, Hariri, who was very much in the architect, kind of the brain, it was the brainchild of Hariri, used dubious methods to kind of silence opposition, etc. But the mobilization around WAQFs was much more successful. So I was interested in better understanding why did this work. And of course, you can just, you know, an easy solution to say, oh, well, you know, of course, these are the elites colluding and this, the Lebanese are sectarian. So, of course, they're going to go behind the sectarian. They're going to go with the sectarian kind of confluence between the prime minister, who is Sunni, and the director general of Islamic WAQFs. And so all of these. But what is interesting is that this is not what happened. I mean, originally, you know, DGIW went with the expropriations and they were going to go with that plan. And it was only through a grassroots mobilization against the alignment of the political, religious, sectarian leaders or the sectarian elite. So it was opposition to that, using a more religious language, that was more successful. So I'm interested in thinking a bit more about that. And another project that has been brewing for a while is about charity and the family again, but here through the Islamic injunction of filial piety, albir bil walidain, and caring for one's aging parents in particular. So it's been a question that's been percolating with me for the last few years, but with the horrendous multiple crisis unfolding now and the waves of immigration, all of these people leaving Lebanon, it's triggering, you know, a lot of effects on elderly people. You know, it's become more urgent, I would say. So I was interested in, you know, how is that injunction lived and interpreted? What does it mean to live a good life when one is nearing one's end of life? So, yeah, so these are some of the things that I'm thinking about. But we will see what happens when I go to Beirut, hopefully at the end of the academic year.
God's Property, Islam, Charity, and the Modern State by Nada Mumtaz, published by University of California Press in 2021 under the Islamic Humanities series. Thank you so much, Nada, for your time and for your intellectual generosity in sharing with us some aspects of this really detailed and incredibly rich new book. It was a pleasure having you, and I'm sure our listeners also really benefited and really enjoyed this conversation as well. So thank you so much. So this was my conversation with Professor Nada Mumtaz about her wonderful and brilliant new book, God's Property, Islam, Charity, and the Modern State. I hope you enjoyed this episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. And I hope you will also join us next time for another fresh episode of NBIS. That is, New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.